Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today on this dinner party of madness, there's Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hello, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty quite decently, I guess. Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello, Danny. How are you doing?
Decently as well.
Anyway, we have a special guest today, and that is Jeremy Smith.
Hi, guys.
How's it going?
How y'all doing?
Is this your third time?
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea.
It feels like the third time.
Oh, man. If we had the resources to marshal a cover of Feels Like the First Time and call it Feels Like the Third Time, you can bet your ass I would do that. Unfortunately, we don't. This is a shoestring operation.
Apologies.
It's not your fault. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. We're going to talk about some of the big goings-on that happened last week in the film world. And then we're going to talk about a film that some of you may have heard of. It's a very small film. I actually told people I was watching this. They had no idea what I was talking about. It's called Coherence. It is an independent sci-fi thriller. So keep your ears open for that when that hits. And we'll be doing our usual thing, talking about what's coming out to Blu-ray and into theaters. We're giving you a personal suggestion and then leaving you. So yeah, that's that. As always, give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. We love it. We can't get enough of it. You can also send us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com, and you can follow us on Twitter @FilmStageShow. And that is that. That's really all for the housekeeping. So we can get into talking about some of the really distressing news that hit last week. First, we'll begin with Lauren Bacall, who passed away. And this was a bit of a shock. I was, you're not really ever expecting something like this unless there's some lead time and maybe like something has happened first. What went through your minds, guys, when you heard this this news?
Oh well. It's with actors who are legendary like this and who we know are still around, there always is that kind of like, when are we going to lose them? And you hate to think about it in that terms, but the thing about Lauren Bacall is that recently I'd seen her like making appearances, and she just seemed as vital as ever. It's one of those people you're just like, I don't think they can die. Right. That's just not.
They're just not allowed.
That's just not supposed to happen. So I mean, it was at 89. I guess I wasn't. Obviously, I don't think I was shocked, but I was. I was certainly in going back over her career. It was very exciting to kind of just think about all of her great work. But then you also get into the fact that the back end of her career wasn't as amazing as perhaps it could have been for a variety of reasons. There's a bit of regret there, but then again, when you've got some of the greatest performances in film history to pick over, it's hard to get too heartbroken about it.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. It's one of those. It's like when someone that you actually know who is lived a full life and who has reached an advanced age passes away. It's almost kind of comforting at that point to look over everything that they've done and be able to see that. One of my favorite films of all time, if anyone knows me, they know I'm a film noir buff, and she was in The Big Sleep playing Vivian Rutledge opposite Humphrey Bogart, and that right there is enough for me to be like, you know what, we've got that. And that's like one of her first movies. So moving on from there, it's just an incredible, incredible career.
And yeah, and she was 19 into Have and Have Not.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy how young she was in that. Actually, I really liked what Glenn Kenny wrote on his blog about her. In that movie, he wrote, I'm going to just read it because it would sound bad paraphrased, but it's, here's the thing with Lauren Bacall. She turned up on screen and there she was, like Venus on that half shell. She was fully formed and all that from frame one. It didn't matter if she could act or not. There she was. And I think that's such a great description of the force she brought to her first movie at that young age is really quite incredible.
Mm-hmm. Nick Newman, any thoughts on this?
Oh, I think this is an echo chamber. I mean, you're not going to get me the badmouth Lauren Bacall exactly.
You're not going to be the firebrand who completely upends our expectations here.
Yeah, I'm not going to single out a bad film or try to justify disliking her or something with some bullshit. That's not going to happen. She's Lauren Bacall. I mean, come on. When she passed, I mean, it was no more than maybe even less than 24 hours after Robin Williams's death. So it was kind of just one of those one after the other things. This as, you know, the United States is crumbling from the inside out in Missouri. It was just a bad week. It was just a really, really bad week. Yeah. And so bad that Lauren Bacall dying was like the third most noteworthy event, I think. The third worst event, if that makes sense. Yeah. Which is not to dispel...
That's not belittling her. Passing. That's talking about how awful it is right now.
Basically, yes. And yeah, so I guess I... what's that?
I was just saying, yeah, it's not bad enough in the real world or in the non-entertainment world that, you know, entertainment has to reflect how shitty everything is in general.
Yeah.
Right. Upon the news of her passing, I thought, well, that's unfortunate, but I also kind of felt the same way. I always feel when an older person who has their legacy established dies, which is, you know, very sad for their family and friends, of course, because I'm not neither of them, I just reflect upon what a good career they had, really. Yeah. The most recent example maybe being like Eli Wallach, for instance. When he passed, I mean, you think about the legacy he left, almost incalculable, really. It was established. It was good. And that's how I felt about Lauren Bacall, you know? Yeah. Went out with her legacy in place. So
yeah, I was going to say, there's, I mean, that. On a personal note, like when my grandfather passed last year, I remember the day of his funeral. He was in the NYPD, so he had the honor guard that carried the casket. And on top of that, when he was actually buried, he was in the Navy during World War II. So he had the naval honor guard there to play taps and fold the flag.
Wow.
And it was just like, looking at that, it was like that, that was the early stages of his life before he retired and then everything else that he'd done. And it was just kind of being able to see those things. In all honesty, it led to a massive existential crisis, because shortly after I said, when I die, I'm going to have like the three friends that remember me and like, I guess my brother, because he's younger, so he'll probably still be around too. And, you know, it's one of those things that kind of makes you realize like the finite amount of time you have and making the most of it. On a completely different level, massive public figure, movie star that we lost last week, Robin Williams passed away. This, much more of a shock than Lauren Bacall's passing. I was out playing board games at like a trendy coffee shop when I found out about this. And this was a lot more difficult to process. And I think that, you know, looking at the internet for the days after, I feel like that's not a controversial statement to make, that it was difficult to process.
It was one of those things when you see it on Twitter and the news first starts breaking and you're just like, you're hoping it's one of those awful parody things where someone just decides to put RIP, someone who you'd be shocked to find had died, and they just do it for shock value, and it's a really crappy way to
like
get
how many
worked
times
up.
Has Jeff Goldblum died on Twitter?
So many. But yeah, this was like to process the passing of Robin Williams. It took quite a long time. I mean, and the day that Bacall died, like I was around to write for our website for Ain't It Cool News, and I had no problem sitting down and saying, okay, I can write about Lauren Bacall. This isn't, I know her work and she has a huge body of work, and it was time. But with Robin Williams, it's not that at all. And it, you know, so many things play into it. The fact that it was suicide and that it was seemingly premature. And there's just an amazing and kind of complicated body of work to pick through, and all of his struggles with substance abuse. And you, I don't know, it was impossible for me to write about it that day. And I still don't know how I feel about it. The only thing I could do was watch The Fisher King that night. And that was just a great way to kind of honor him and also just bawl my eyes out, which I think I needed to do.
Yeah. I remember having a similar reaction where I was wondering, you know, how someone would approach trying to summarize that filmography, because it seemed like such a daunting task. And it seemed like the common narrative that developed a little bit was just the balance of comedy and sadness in his work. And that's certainly something that left an impression on me even as a kid watching, like, Mrs. Doubtfire, because so much of that movie is so funny, but I still remember those divorce scenes like left an impact. And so, like, even in something like that, which is sort of this TV staple that you kind of have to watch every time you come across it, there is that, like, undercurrent of sadness. And I remember for some reason I watched One Hour Photo when I was pretty young. And that's, like, a terrible movie to watch if you, like, live in the suburbs, because it could pretty much take place like 10 minutes from where you live. And it's a terrifying performance and a really good one. And that's the same year as, like, Insomnia. So I remember I was surprised at that kind of common narrative that developed, but I do think it sums up a lot of his work. And certainly for years, I haven't thought of him just as, you know, this crazy comedic figure. There's definitely been a kind of dramatic power to his work.
Definitely, yeah.
Nick Newman?
I mean, when I heard it, it was surprising, certainly, but then I kind of, actually before it was made official, I was kind of doing some searching to see what his recent history with substance abuse was, because, maybe this will lighten the mood a bit, he has one of my favorite lines about drug use. It's something I think about every couple of weeks, and in fact I thought of just a couple of days before he died, which is, cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money. Yeah. And so when I heard that he died prematurely and then word got out that it was a suicide, I thought, oh, I wonder what his recent history was. And then I looked it up and I saw that he had been in rehab just as recently as like 2006 or something. And, you know, that kind of, that definitely became a factor as far as how I was perceiving the death, and how could it not, really? And when it came to just the filmography itself, I mean, yeah, no, it was one of the things I thought it was interesting. I thought it was good, but a lot of people brought up that, you know, recently he had been making some pretty roundly terrible films, but, it was him that people cared about. You know, it was almost like the work didn't matter. It was him as a person who was really making the impact, who everybody had the fond memories of. I thought it was interesting how Ignaty Vyshnovetsky wrote this kind of medium-length obituary for him at the EV Club, and he said that he was the first movie star whose voice he recognized, which I could definitely see, because I think about all the movies I watched with him as a kid, like Mrs. Doubtfire, which, as a child of divorce, you know, that movie actually... I mean, Mrs. Doubtfire is like a stupid movie, but like it did help. It did help sort of crystallize a lot of ideas at the time. Something the movie maybe doesn't get quite enough credit for, and you know, something like Jumanji as well, which I loved, and you know, it was just it was. I mean, I don't know what else to say, except it's very sad, because I hate that it takes a famous person's death, famous person's premature death, to bring light to certain issues, but it is good, at least, to see that in light of his death, people are talking more about the menace that is clinical depression, and it seems like people are, through the lens of this very untimely, very awful passing, are taking maybe putting a more sympathetic lens on it than they normally would. It's helping them understand it a bit. It's kind of like when Philip Seymour Hoffman died, and I said that one unexpected legacy of his might be helping people further understand something like drug addiction.
Yeah.
You know, because you see how talented a person could be, how towering a presence they could be, and how they could still be weighed down by this thing and ultimately killed by it. And that's something I've kind of been taking away from it in the 7 days since it happened. But yeah, it was. I actually found out the news right before I was on vacation. Actually, what a perfect week that was to go on a vacation. And I found out the news on the first day of vacation too. I found out the news like right before I was about to go to dinner, and I was just sitting at dinner. I really didn't feel like talking to anybody, or you know, making small niceties centered chat because I was just so depressed about it. Because it was just one of those things that you just kind of sit there, and it just kind of weighs with you. In a way you don't always expect, especially because I had not seen a Williams film, I think, in some time. But, you know, he was always, again, he had the line about cocaine, which always stuck with me. I was thinking about just a couple of days before. Like, he always had a presence somewhere. And, you know, he still will, thankfully. That's the good part of it, at least, is that he's not going to, you know, it's not like he's going to dissipate. He was in so much stuff that has a lasting impact on people. Everything from something like Mrs. Doubtfire to One Hour Photo or Insomnia or Good Will Hunting on the more serious side of things. So incredibly versatile actor. And it's nice to see that kind of bloom again, that appreciation. Also an appreciation for The Birdcage, which I've always liked quite a bit. It's good to see people talking about that again, even if it's under essentially the worst of circumstances.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting to, because so many people were well, not so many people, but there were some people bringing up the idea that, oh, you know, we're mourning him now, and you know, the work had not been so good lately. And I'm like, well, you know, it wasn't so long ago that he did World's Greatest Dad,
which was great,
the Bobcat Goldthwait film, which is not exactly the film you want to watch to appreciate him immediately following a suicide. However, you know, I think the thing about Robin Williams to keep in mind is that part of his, I think, you know, his own therapy, at least, you know, at least a personal, like, self-medicating thing was to work and to, you know, he had this, he would take roles in all types of films. Some of them were not good. Some were great, but he liked to work. It was, I think that kind of helped keep the darkness at bay. And, you know, I remember I live very close to the UCB theater out here in Los Angeles. And when the theater first opened up, Robin started showing up at the theater, like in the evening, and asking if he could go on with like certain improv groups. And they were all like, are you kidding me? Absolutely. And so Robin would go on, and he was showing up every night. And, you know, to the point where I was kind of like, I wonder if these people are like, hey, you know, we kind of want to do our own stuff. We don't want to have it become the Robin Williams show. And he was just getting such a high off that. Unfortunately, he was then going to the bar next door, Birds, and he kept the party going and was drinking and having a great time, dancing on the bar. Pictures got out. And, you know, and the thing was, he was just wanted to see everyone having a great time. And the fact that Robin Williams was there drinking and dancing on the bar and making everyone laugh, they were all like, just, oh, it was a great free show from one of the great comedians. And then all of a sudden, the statement came out from his publicist that Robin was going back to rehab. I believe that was the 06-07 incident. Wow. And that was that. I don't think he ever came back to the UCB theater. But again, I guess that's kind of the work was a way of coping. And at some point, I guess that didn't help anymore.
Yeah.
Well,
I know that Nick, you know, you brought up again, like you did with Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, at least there can be some good that comes of it just through the kind of the spotlight it puts on a specific issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I had friends who were just shocked to find out that not only had he passed, but that it was by his own hand. And you know, it's something that I have had way too much experience with in my life. This concept of the person who's at the center of attention, who everyone loves and everyone wants to be around, and they're like the loneliest or the most depressed person. And for me, it was it was difficult to process, not in so much as because it happened, but because everyone else seemed to be so shocked by it. looking at Robin Williams and the way that he would act and the way that, especially like in things like his stand-up, the way that he kind of fed off of the audience, it was such a clear reflection of someone who was in need of that. And so, to me, it felt good to see people jarred out of this complacency of, like, what is the face of depression, and being able to see that. That resonated with me more strongly than anything. It's the same thing. I said the same thing to my friends when this happened that I did when a really close friend of mine killed himself back in college. And it was, I'm shocked, but I'm not surprised. It's, you know, the unfortunate, terrible truth is that sometimes you can just see it in people. And all of that fun and that energy is sort of like an engine that's burning out and about to combust. And you're just waiting for it to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely agree with you on that. I haven't even been able to go back and watch any of his movies yet, and I have quite a few. And I'd actually been wanting to see 1 Hour Photo again, so that's going to have to wait.
I would recommend The Fisher King, even though it is a tough film at times, but it is ultimately, it's hopeful, and it's got such a generous spirit that I think you'll feel happy you watched that.
Yeah. Well, the other one that I really wanted to watch was What Dreams May Come, because I'm one of the few people who unabashedly loves that movie. Again, not the type of movie you want to watch right after hearing about something like that happening. So I'm on a Robin Williams break. I did not respond like everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were a couple other sort of under-the-radar titles that kept popping up that I we'll probably see soon. There was like Moscow on the Hudson, which was directed by Paul Mazursky, who also died this year. Cadillac Man was getting some love, and also this film called Being Human. And so I thought I'd give those a shout out. Also, I'll probably get to watching some of his stand-up once I start going through this, because I haven't seen that much.
I was going to say, I think I even mentioned on this podcast once, The Final Cut. It was a very small independent sci-fi film with the concept of, like, kids, when you're first born, you're implanted with, like, an implant that records everything you see. And then you have these editors who go through and create, like, a montage memorial of your life through your eyes. And he happens to be one of these editors. And it's about his life and the loneliness that's involved in that. So,
yeah. And if you're... I was going to say, if you're looking to watch his stand-up, the Night at the Met is like one of the all-time great stand-up comedy performances.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, when I told my roommate when I saw the news on Twitter, he was like, yeah, I'll miss him as an actor, but he's absolutely like my favorite stand-up comedian of all time.
Yeah, his stand-up was like kinetic. It was sometimes it was almost unbearable to watch just because it was like everything coming at you at once, but in the best kind of way. That was and there's not really anyone else you can say that about, who they're just kind of like a wave coming at you, and you just got to hold on and hope for the best when you're watching it. I guess that's about it. There's not a lot more to say. Obviously, we could talk about his filmography for like 14 podcasts. But, you know, it's a stark reminder of just the way that, you know, the human mind and spirit processes things. And if, you know, there's suicide is contagious is the problem. And so the concern that I'd have is that people who heard about this might get this concept of, if he can't be happy, then I never can be happy. Do not think of it that way. Now that the topic is in the open, people are going to be more receptive to hearing from you. So if that's a problem, I would suggest that you reach out to someone or some organization. So that's my small editorial on that. So let's get into the movie business, though. Let's
bring a little coherence to this podcast with the review, shall we?
I don't know if that play on words works that well, but yeah, let's pull it back and let's do the thing that our websites actually pay us to do every now and then. Let's talk about a movie. Let's talk about Coherence. This is a science fiction film, as I said, by director James Ward Burkett. And he also co-wrote the screenplay, or he wrote the screenplay, and then he co-wrote the story with Alex Manoogian. It stars a bunch of unknown actors and actresses. At least I didn't pick up on any ones that I recognized. And it is about a house party, a dinner party, amongst a couple of friends.
That guy was on Roswell for 4 years.
Is that real, though? I thought that was just a thing they said.
No, he actually he was Nicholas Brendan. At least, you know, he was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer for many, many seasons as Xander. And so that whole Roswell thing, I was sitting there going, not that I was a Roswell fan, but I was like, that's odd. They actually invented. He was never on it. They actually invented a character that he was like one of the leads in the show, which actually plays into something. I don't know. Maybe we should talk about later as we get into the film. But
that's actually a good point that you got right there. I hadn't even thought about that. I only looked up Roswell and I was like, that guy wasn't on fucking Roswell. Anyway,
terrible joke.
Anyway, so eight friends at a dinner party. A comet is passing overhead, and electrical trouble is just the beginning of the disquieting occurrences that they have to weather throughout the night. This film is now on VOD. You can watch it. I would assume other people at least could watch it on their cable video on demand options. I'll have a funny story about that later. It's also available on Amazon and iTunes. So yeah, this is Coherence.
Amir's bringing Laurie to dinner.
Amir's a total jackass.
Everyone else still not have service.
I got zero. No.
On the news, you know, they're talking about the comet.
Yeah, yeah.
Wheeler's comet.
After it passed, people get lost. They would end up in the wrong home. What? And they keep telling people that this can happen.
The chicken tastes like tuna. It must be Wheeler's comet.
So, Jeremy, you had already seen this, and our esteemed editor-in-chief, Jordan, actually recommended you as our guest this week because he said that you were kind of a booster for this. So I'd like to begin with you. Where did you first see this, and what were your thoughts on it?
I first saw it on, VOD. Well, actually, not VOD, a screener. But it had already received a good deal of critical acclaim by this point. I think it had played Fantastic Fest. Perhaps maybe it was a selection at Sundance or one of the other film festivals. So it had some pretty big name critics backing it. Namely, I know Mike D'Angelo was one who was really a supporter. Gave it, I believe, 4.5 stars at the Dissolve. And I don't know if Mike's
for him is
Yeah, Mike is probably one of the toughest critics around, and that is like one of those, oh boy, I got to watch this, recommendations. Not that I always agree with him, but my tastes do tend to dovetail with his. And it is it was exciting because I heard pitch as a Twilight Zone-inspired film, like it was kind of like an episode done at And the runtime I heard was like under 90 minutes, where I was like, okay, great for a Twilight Zone episode. That's kind of perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds like they were economical and at least I hope they were. And so, going into it, I tried to know as little as possible. And I highly recommend that approach, because the first time through it is a really, at first it's unnerving. And as things begin to get revealed, becomes a very actually frightening movie. There are certain reveals that just absolutely, at least psychologically, I mean, I found it somewhat terrifying. And watching this cast again, you know, like we were saying, Nicholas Brendan's the only guy I knew. I'd never seen these people together before, but I bought them immediately as friends who hang out. There were certain characters I liked, certain characters I really loathed. one of which keeps trying to recommend characters take ketamine, which just is kind of like, it's one of those things where you're like, ah, oh, God. And so, yeah, it's just the dynamic of it. And as an ensemble piece is really great. And then it also has this very heady idea as a piece of science fiction, but is not so the hard science of it. When you go back and look at it, is not it's not defined. It's not the kind of thing that, you know, it doesn't all add up in a way, but it's not supposed to. So it's not like Primer, where I think, you know, when people saw Primer, they went out and diagrammed it and tried to figure out everything.
Yeah.
And if you tried to do that with Coherence, you'd get nowhere.
Which is kind of the point, which is great.
Right, yeah, because there's the great thing is, so much of what it introduces kind of heady concepts and brings up things like Schrodinger's cat, and you're kind of like, oh, is this what it is? And no, it's like along the way, it's just everything is kind of a red herring. And it's pointing you in different directions, and it is so much fun. It's such a great mind. You know, am I allowed to say mind F? Are you? Do you?
Oh, we curse on this thing all the fucking time.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
All right, mind fuck. And yeah, it's just rare to see. And it was, you know, it's a very low budget film, but it doesn't feel cheap. It's intellectually, it is. It's one of the most thrilling experiences I've had in a long time with a genre film. It's exactly what I wish more science fiction films could be.
All right. Nick Newman, what about yourself?
So I watched Coherence last night. I think I sort of made the mistake of having a long travel day and then watching this movie. Because as you can imagine, you've been traveling all day. Your mind is not really in its most solid state.
Yeah, your thoughts aren't very coherent.
Exactly. And yet, watching the movie, I think I was able to process it well enough, and I think I'm a little more mixed on it than our esteemed guest, and perhaps more mixed than my semi-esteemed co-hosts, when I say that I liked Coherence an okay amount, but for me, it was one of those examples of a film that, as I'm watching, I'm thinking maybe this is going to be a bit more than the sum of its parts, because I'm very intrigued by the concepts and the conceits, which are kind of hovering over the action, which are dictating the action in a very kind of, I don't want to say incidental way, because that's certainly not the case, but in a way that's not totally pronounced. And that was kind of exciting to see the science fiction movie that, you know, with its low budget, with its very interesting idea, can move along without having to state too loudly the ramifications of its conceit. It can have something such as, you know, a group of characters walking down the street and then they see their mirror selves walking in the other direction. And as Jeremy said, I don't know if this is specifically what he's referring to, but it is one of those things that I find very unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very powerful image that you can achieve with basically no budget. And in this sort of recent trend of low budget science fiction features, it's always exciting to see something like that. Ultimately, I found that the movie wasn't exactly pulling me as far as anything past the conceit is concerned. The human drama contained within was, if not, the thing is, there's the quality to this movie that is appreciably realistic, which is you have like the pre-party scenes where this tension of like, oh, this person's coming with this person, and this person very much. Which, I mean, I'm going to be entering my senior year of college next week, so you can imagine that's something I'm familiar with.
And it never goes away.
And I'm sure it never goes away.
If we have any college students listening right now who think that that's something that you will grow out of, it is not.
No, right, it gets worse.
It gets appreciably worse. It's just
if you think
it's about
you're
half
petty
of
now,
my social life.
Yeah, you think you're petty now, man. Oh, just wait.
And and the movie, I think, nails that in a very not that you can nail something in an imprecise way, but okay, it nails it in a precise way. I'll just say that. But it does it on a writing level. As far as the formalism of this Burkitt fellow is concerned, I was kind of, I don't know, formally it felt very caustic to me. It felt so herky jerky. I don't know if that's an expression, herky jerky.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
The film is so quickly cut, and there's all this shaky cam, and there are all these shots that are where the focus is racked in the middle of an image that is not necessarily one that really requires racking. You just have a shot on someone's face, and the focus keeps shifting, almost as if this is like an episode of The Office or something. Yeah. The problem is that it's not a mockumentary, and I found that really kind of distracting when I'm kind of getting into the movie, you know, on the level of scripting and conceit. You know, the woman's phone cracks as she's talking on it, and it has something to do with a comet that's coming. I'm really excited by that. That's an interesting idea. But there's just so much going on visually that feels unnecessary to me. You know, you have all of these cuts, and you have all of these faces that you're focusing on in a conversation. And it's not that it's done in a completely sloppy way. It's just that it feels really manic, you know, and that kept kind of pulling me out of it. As far as the rest of the film is concerned, I mean, some of the performances are less than terrific. Some of them kind of feel like amateur actors. The movie this reminded me most of in that regard was this science fiction movie from several years ago called The Man from Earth. Has anybody here seen that?
No.
It was really popular on Netflix Watch Instantly for like a couple of years. It was one of those movies that everybody sees through that service. And it was this sort of like this posthumous work by a writer named Jerome Z. It's about this guy who claims to be the oldest man on the planet Earth, basically. The whole movie takes place sitting in a room with his friends explaining how he could actually be like 15,000 years old. A very intriguing idea. I'm sure that people who hear this will, you know, if they haven't seen it, they'll think to themselves, I want to see a movie like that. Well, Coherence is quite similar, really, where you hear this conceit and then you think, okay, let's see where this goes. And I kind of had that same reaction throughout, where I was still compelled by it. I was still curious to see where it headed, but ultimately, I don't know. I'm not sure how interested I was in any of the people it was affecting. With one scene accepted, it kind of felt more like a run through of a really good idea than a film fulfilling all of its potential, if that makes sense. So I would give it a light. I mean, I rented it for $5. So if the idea is interesting to you and you have access to Amazon, and I'm sure you probably do if you're listening to the show, you know, okay, well, it's worth giving a shot at least. It's certainly more interesting than half the things that are playing in theaters now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, absolutely. Danny King, what about yourself?
Yeah, I also liked Coherence. I had known going in that it had this sci-fi hook, so I was sort of waiting for that, and I enjoyed the way, in terms of the filmmaking, that he sort of dropped hints of that with these really unsettling fades to black in the middle of these conversations. Hard cuts to black. That just like they keep popping up, and they sort of disappear as the film goes on. But I found that really entertaining in the early scenes because, I mean, the drama itself is familiar dinner party stuff, but it's pretty enjoyable. And then to have their sort of chit-chat just interrupted by these cuts was, I thought, really fun. But the movie, I made a mistake by watching this movie in, like, the late afternoon-ish, just because this movie takes place at night in very dark rooms. And even the opening shot, which seemed really interesting, where it's, like, from behind the main character as she's in her car, and then all of a sudden her phone breaks, and it's a really good opening tease, but I just had trouble seeing the image, so that's just on me. In terms of what I liked and didn't like about the film, I think that it is best when it focuses on M, and that plays more into the end, which we can get into. But I think,
and when you say M, you're talking about the main character, Emma.
Yeah, the character M, played by, what's the actress's name?
Emily Foxler.
She was really good, and I think where it goes with her character, it seems like the movie finally reckoning with its ideas head on, rather than just having characters talk about it in a room. I was intrigued to learn that the film was pretty much totally improvised, and it was shot over like 5 days, and I think that accounts for the style, certainly, where you can imagine the director just trying to catch these performances while they're happening, and then probably trying to cover up a lot of lapses in editing. So I think the chaos is certainly intentional, but I also found maybe some of the focus work a little bit distracting. But yeah, I just think there were some patches in the middle of the film where it didn't, some of the tension sort of dripped out once it didn't focus on the main character, and I wasn't totally invested in some of the other ones. But overall, I would recommend the movie, and I think it's, you know, what we've said, kind of a really, ultimately, it's a pretty haunting kind of look at what would happen if there were, like, other versions of us.
Yeah, so I wanted to go into this movie as pure as possible. And this is the problem with doing that. I had no idea what the movie was about. I think when, again, our esteemed editor-in-chief, Jordan, said we should watch this instead of having to go out and see whatever the hell else came out this weekend, I was like, great. I know that it's something about a dinner party. I know nothing else. So I began watching this on VOD. Coherence. Great. Perfect. I see a woman driving a car. I cannot hear her conversation on the phone. It's all muddled. I'm thinking, okay, this is like unimportant, and so they're just doing ambient music to set the mood. She looks at her phone and it's broken. I'm like, okay, that's great. That's an interesting way. I guess they're going to cut to sound now. Then I see people preparing a meal. I don't see any faces for a while. And so I think it's just a meal. Meanwhile, I can hear crickets. Like, the sounds, the ambient sounds of a dinner party at night are all present. There are no voices. For a second, I think maybe there's something wrong with the audio. And then the music starts to swell, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, I guess sooner or later they're going to start to, I'm going to start to be able to hear their words. A good 5 minutes after they've sat down at a table, after every character has walked in and had an introduction, I pause the movie, and I'm like, okay. And so I tweet out, hoping that someone will see it or something. I'm just going to assume that this movie is supposed to not have dialogue. Begin movie, like, from the place that I paused. Keep going. Finally, I'm like, you know what? This has got to be wrong. But I was, like, so, I was so wanted to keep the secret of the movie that I didn't want to, like, type into Google, like, coherence, no dialogue, ? Because I didn't want it to be, like, oh yeah, there's a point like 20 minutes in where suddenly everyone starts speaking and they all look terrified or something. So then I finally just emailed you guys. I was like, is there supposed to be audible dialogue in the first part of this movie? And there was. So started it again on Amazon. So thank you, Verizon, because that was weird as hell. I have to say, though, that I was still very intrigued, just the body language and everything. And then, so Amazon giving me the dialogue, I was even more intrigued. I will say that there are some ways in which not having the dialogue helped, at least at the outset. In a movie like this, where the concept is so alien, needing to come up with a reason for it to happen is something of a detriment. So, like, her openly stating, like, my phone broke. I wonder if it has to do with that comet. Like, that's, you know, you don't need a comet to start something like this. You could make it anything. Cosmic rays, position of the moon. It doesn't really matter. The fact that they go back to it every now and then, and that it more or less just becomes like a ticking clock type of thing, kind of mitigates that a bit. But aside from some rookie things like that, I loved this movie. Jeremy, I said holy shit out loud so many times during this movie. it was incredible. I had, like, something would happen and I would understand the meaning behind it, and it was very unsettling and very scary. And I was glad that I was alone in the house, because I wouldn't want someone to rush into the room and say, what's wrong? And for me to say, the numbers on the pad, blah, blah, blah. And then they would just look at me like I was crazy. This movie is one of those rare feats where even though they over-explain the meaning behind, like, what made the incident happen, they were perfect at showing the way in which these people respond and kind of teasing out the details and letting you understand the mechanics so that you could read them yourself.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. I mean, I've said
this. You never thought the color of a glow stick would freak you out.
Yeah. The color of a glow stick, the color of a marker. I mean, it was great. And the way that it blossoms outwards from there, because you get this concept of, okay, I get this. I've seen the monsters are due on Maple Street.
Mm-hmm.
I can figure this out. And then it just kind of keeps subverting you, not in a bananas way, like, you know, suddenly, you know, it's Planet of the Apes style. No, it's all still working within that same logic that it's created, and it's great. And yeah, I mean, you can tell that it's a low-budget film. Some of, like, the things where they just do a close-up on wine glasses and everyone's talking and, you know, the rack focus. God, you know what, Nick? The second that I watched this, I knew you were going to bring up the rack and the focus, because it's just what you do. I don't understand it.
what? It's a formal... Come on.
I know, but I listen to a lot of podcasts, and you, sir, are the only person who ever brings up rack focus, which I like about you. I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
I didn't even know I bring it up very often, honestly.
Yeah, you do it every now and then. The most.
Actually, with every film, it's the first thing Nick says.
It's almost like Tourette's. I've had to start editing it out.
Right.
Actually, I just reread D'Angelo's review, and he brought up the rack focus.
Oh, really?
Oh.
Yeah. He was saying it was just one of the, you know, which seems, and I think I would agree with him, is that it's there's a visual kind of imprecision or, you know, it's going to happen when you shoot a movie in 5 days.
Right.
And,
oh,
and
this was shot in 5 days?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
So I think that
that's
they were,
incredible.
Yeah. I guess in that way, it's like I'm willing to cut it some slack. But, I mean, you know, I didn't know that when I watched it the first time. So,
yeah.
So yeah, I, you know, I noticed. I was like, yeah, this is like awfully handheld and a bit, you know, formally. It's not a aesthetically. It's not a terribly a pleasing film, but
it's not,
I guess,
ugly. I mean, like, it's just,
but
you know.
Yeah, but there are things that, you know, when a concept gets me, when I'm hooked in to the story and into the, just, you know, the what the movie's about, I tend to let those technical things slide, yeah. Provided they're not like Ed Wood level inept. Like,
for me, in this film, you could rack focus like a motherfucker, and I wouldn't care, because, again, like, how many times is someone looking at their glow stick gonna freak you out to the point that it does in this film? I mean, that's the type of thing that no rack focus could ever take away from me. I also just kind of liked it because
this is like Brian Roan versus the rack focus.
Roan on racking. That's going to be my new solo podcast where I only review movies based on the use of rack focus. I got a brand new camera. It's really nice. It's a Canon 7D. It's the same kind of camera that is used by Ella Coltrane in the movie Boyhood. Anyway, that's a problem. So yeah, I was at my friend's baby shower. And I was using the video function for the first time. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. But again, I had to rack the focus nearly constantly because the depth of field on this damn camera, or on this lens I was using, is so shallow. But I mean, seeing that in this film actually for me kind of worked, because I was now used to the like, you know, it's a crazy situation. Like, you can't frame that. Like, you don't know that that person's going to pick up that glass or put that down there. So I don't mind the rack focus in this. We've now spent 6 minutes talking about rack focus, alienating everyone. I loved this film. I immediately texted a couple friends of mine and told them that they had to watch it so we could check it out and talk about it, because it's great. And I love finding small films like this, things like Primer. I mean, it was the same type of situation, you know, watching it and you're like, and it's also, it's one of those movies that I think really kind of invigorates the creative spirit in a person, especially now finding out that they made it in 5 days. If you have a concept like this and you really work through it, it's, you can make it. Like, I know it's easy to look at something like Transformers and think, my God, we're doomed. I could never do this. What am I like? It's not. It's not impossible. And actually, we had an interview. I interviewed, I should say, a producer who'd written a book about making movies, and he was saying that the way that technology has changed and made it easier for people to make professional-looking movies, a lot of people look at that as kind of a downfall, because now you don't have to be Terrence Malick in order to make a movie that looks like a Terrence Malick movie. But it does allow people to tell stories that might not otherwise get told in a way that won't immediately be written off because it was shot on a VHS tape. Yeah. And so this is one of those creatively energizing films that is just, it's great.
And what's funny is Burkitt, a lot of his work experience so far has been with Gore Verbinski as a storyboard artist. And he has a story credit on Rango.
Now everything falls into place.
Right, to see him go from like Pirates of the Caribbean to Coherence is kind of amusing. And also you can imagine like to be working as a storyboard artist and then to kind of allow yourself to make a movie that's totally unplanned is pretty interesting. And, you know, I think he did pull it off for the most part.
So in terms of plot, we've done a really good job of not really saying what some of these twists are. Do we want to get into spoilers really quick? Does anyone feel like discussing the end of this film in particular will do anything? Or do we want to leave it as a...
I don't know, because there's more to this after. So I don't, you know, you don't want your viewer or your listeners to stop listening. So it's a very conscious decision if you want to go there or not.
We do chapters, actually. So, I mean, people probably either forget or fail to realize this. If you use the buttons at the bottom of your player and you hit the next chapter button, you'll skip over whatever section comes next. It's a function that, like, no one else uses, and I don't know why. But, yeah, so I say, screw it. We're going to go into spoilers. If you don't want to hear spoilers for this, either pause this, watch the movie, come back in an hour and a half and listen, or use the chapter selection arrow to listen to what's coming out in the week ahead. So spoilers for Coherence. Jeremy, lay it on us. What did you think about it all?
I really liked that it ended up being about M. That they kind of seized on the whole... I mean, it's not the most original twist to end it with M finding the version of herself, or the alternate dimension in which... she didn't, she became a star, a ballerina, and mm-hmm. you know, like things worked out, and that's where she wants to be, and that is, and you know, so this, you know, the idea that it's just about, and she kind of goes into that reality, and then I think it then makes it a personal thing that it, there is an emotional connection you're allowed to have to the film, and it's not just this mind game that ends, you know, on some kind of like tricky, you know, twist at the end. It's not, and it ends unresolved, which I really like.
Mm-hmm. You know, I love that too. I love that. As I said, I thought at first it was just going to be like tribe warfare between the two houses, and then it turns out there's like an infinite number of houses, and that they've become mixed up to the point that it's almost impossible to know where home is anymore once you've passed through that dark area between the two blocks.
Yes.
And
which is described as a roulette wheel.
Yeah.
Which I love. Yeah. And then you just kind of, you go out and you end up where you end up, and it's, yeah, that's fantastic.
It's great. And, it was a point when I was watching this movie and I was like, everyone's really freaking out about this, but I mean, you know, maybe it's not so bad. You know, you like, It's one of those things where it's like, let's say that reality splits off and now it's like my house is on the other side of my street. But I mean, it's if I were to swap with that other guy, it wouldn't be different people. I'd probably still hate the same people I hated. I'd probably still like the same people I liked. And if I didn't, you know what? That kind of shit changes on a daily basis anyway. I'm not like most people, though. I'm sure that most of my friends would be freaking the fuck out. But I like that it kind of let that terror sink in. And then it allowed her to say to herself, to make that decisive, bold move, to just be like, you know what? I'm going out there. And I don't know what I'm going to find, but I'm going to find a place that's for me. And then she takes it violently, but ultimately probably incompletely.
Yeah, I think the movie for me, opens up when she finally leaves that house. Because for a while, when they're just talking about the implications, it's very unsettling. But I feel like it would also be unsettling if I just read the book they mention or read some other related piece of writing and just thought about it by myself. Mm-hmm. But to actually see her go through it, and even before she turns violent, when she's just walking down at night and looking into each house, that's...
And seeing all the stuff that's happening.
Yeah, that's when it became like... that's when it excelled for me, because you're actually looking at it through her eyes and it's not just people chatting about it.
And it was the ramping up, because at first you think maybe it's a time paradox, because like a guy is going to leave a note and then the note appears on his door or you know, other things like that. And then suddenly you're like, oh no, wait, they have different color glow sticks. Oh wow, that's okay, so they are different people. And then the two guys who first came back and you're like, oh thank God they made it. When they're finally alone, they pull out their glow sticks, which are red instead of blue. And they're like, we have to get the fuck out of here. And that was like a moment. It was a shock. And then it was a strange moment of comedy, because you realize that like every single one of the, none of these people are going to handle this that well. Well, and then she finally finds the one that does. And then she, you know, fucks it all up.
Yeah. And it's the idea of, you know, and the worry that it's like, oh, well, they're further along than we are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, mm-hmm. It's like they've already figured this out.
Yeah. So we're behind. We, oh, God, now what, you know, how do we somehow get a foothold, or how do we, you know, get, take an angle at which, you know, we're able to get ahead of them.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that.
I love the guy who was worried that he was drinking in a different place. Because it's like, I know my problems and my issues, my demons. And I may be controlling them, but, you know, me number two might be going full tilt. And the last thing I want is for me number two to come and kill my friends number one. Yeah. And I was just like, holy shit, this is insanity. It was so good. When she opens that, first of all, again, talking about the things that I like where things are a little different and you're able to just kind of infer stuff. Like when she goes outside to her car and she runs into her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And they both silently realize that they're not from the same house. And they just kind of walk away. And then she opens up the book, and it's a completely different set of colored numbers. And then she starts asking people, and she's like circling the numbers that they're choosing from. And they're just realizing that they've gotten mixed up to the point that they can probably never get back. But again, it's like, I guess, again, I'm a little more pragmatic. It's like, you know what? That's fine.
Well, and you know, it's funny, this whole idea of like multi-dimensionality is something that is, I mean, it's accepted and like it has been written about by some of like the greatest minds of our time. And so they are playing around with something that is like, I guess, like Dr. or, you know, probably Stephen Hawking believes in and Kip Thorne and all of these.
I was
big
really
brain.
Hoping when you said doctor that you were going to come out and say Doctor Who.
Dr. Phil. But yeah, and that's, so it's like, you know, these are concepts that people, you know, that, again, that it's exploring stuff that no other film would really get into. I'm not saying that it does so in a way that is, you know, that it's actually about those things. It's just using them to really play with these, to allow these different things to happen with characters, to allow these different conflicts to, and conflicts between two of the same people to emerge. And I think that that's fascinating. And the fact that M would then feel, you know, the whole idea of being able to assault and possibly kill another, you know, her in another dimension is just kind of mind blowing. And it's like, well, you know, I'm just killing myself.
Right. Well, it's like the fear of dying is the fear of not being able to live anymore. So right. If you kill yourself in another dimension, not suicide, but literally murder your double, you know, what does it matter?
Well, it's that version. It's that person's problem. It's that version of yourself. It's their problem, not yours.
Yeah, their life is mine now. I can live better than them.
Yep. Or I can enjoy the part, you know, the life that I'd like to live.
Yeah. Oh, man. Coherence. Really good film. Definitely tell you to check it out. Nick, you sound like the least enthusiastic of all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. All right,
so
well,
it is.
Coherence out in on VOD now. Definitely worth the $4 rental for SD, $5 rental for HD. Just get HD, guys. It's another goddamn dollar. Is this coming to theaters? Is it in any theaters?
It was already in theaters.
Yeah, I missed it in theaters.
This? I hate
yeah.
it when these tiny films come out and I miss them.
Oh, it also references Sliding Doors.
Oh, God, yeah.
Bringing recognition to that masterwork. So.
The other
not to be such an asshole, but to kind of be an asshole, really you should be referencing Blind Chance.
Right, right. I actually just saw that, too.
Okay, anyway. Do these people look like they've seen Blind Chance?
No, they're
no,
if they've
not.
Seen any Kieslowski, they've seen the Three Colors, probably. Maybe Double Life of Veronique. I doubt maybe one of them saw the Decalogue. Maybe.
What was I gonna say?
Well, at least a short film about love, right?
Yeah, yeah. The short film about killing. Yeah.
This is where everybody tunes out of the show, by the way. I'm glad to have done that. But yeah.
All right. Yeah, so that's that. I was gonna say the other convenient thing that his brother is like a crazy sort of theoretical physicist,
mm-hmm.
and was like, not that I'm saying that something's gonna happen, but if something happens, you're gonna want to get in touch with me really goddamn quick.
Yeah,
and then my book is in the back of your car. Though I did love the fact that the only reason they have the book that cues them into the idea of coherence and decoherence is first they have to be like, what do I look? I'm not a scientist. I got like some Shakespeare. I got some Thomas Miller plays. No. And then it's like, oh, I was going to mail that to him, but I threw it in the back of the car and forgot about it. And at that moment, I was like, oh, God, I have a lot of stuff in the back of my car that I forgot about. Sorry, laundry. Yeah, so that was fun. But at the same time, it was just like, really, bro, you got a brother who is a crazy theoretical physicist who was telling you that something might happen. Again, not entirely necessary, but acceptable, because it got us to where I wanted to be, which was in this wonderful movie. Coming to Blu-ray and DVD. Oh, boy. We have The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is you can get in a handsome commemorative packaging that looks like Electro's head. So there's that if you'd like. Coming to Criterion Blu-ray, Y Tu Mama Tambien.
Yay.
We also have Leviathan coming to Blu-ray. Criterion, Time Me Up, Time Me Down. The Flintstones, for some reason, the live-action version is coming to Blu-ray. Have fun with that one, guys.
Oh, Fading Gigolo.
Fading Gigolo, Only Lovers Left Alive. The Quiet Ones, Rosemary's Baby, the television miniseries. Jarhead 2, which I'm just going to let slide. And then we got some fun-looking double features that we always love talking about. Any of these things looking like a good time to you guys?
It's funny because last time Jeremy was on this podcast, we talked about Gravity, mm-hmm. a far inferior Quran film compared to Y Tu Mama Tambien.
I guess that's okay.
Which is a wonderful movie. And
as was Gravity, in a completely different way.
Sure.
I can't believe that you're still not on the Gravity train.
If I wasn't when I saw it in IMAX 3D, why would I be now? So there's Y Tu Mama Tambien, which I love. I've never seen Time Me Up, Time Me Down. Really, I mean, Only Lovers Left Alive I adore. Amazing Spider-Man 2, who gives a fucking shit about that movie? Seriously. I hate what that franchise has done to Andrew Garfield, make him be Spider-Man for years. The only good thing about the Spider-Man 3 delay is that he can do like some like actual work for a bit before he has to get sucked back into it. Wasn't that reviewed on this show? Like, wasn't I on a podcast where that was reviewed?
I know that I had to watch it and then talk about it. I'm assuming it's for this because, yeah. I remember not being that big of a fan.
I remember writing my review for Anna Cool of Amazing Spider-Man 2 and then stopping for a moment, and I was like, I go back to look at my review for the first film. I was rewriting my review for the first film.
I remember being soft on this movie, not in like, ooh, I like it, but like, it could be worse. But I mean, it would have had to try.
Yeah,
my favorite part is still the fact that there's a dubstep playing that is telling you what's going on inside Electro's head. like great, literally, yeah. literally like a Terrence Malick monologue via dubstep.
What?
Worth it just for that, guys. Worth it just for that.
So there's E2 Mom and there's Only Lovers. I'll also recommend the fourth season of Boardwalk Empire is on Blu-ray. And I've been a big fan of the show since the beginning, really. But the fourth season, I think, was easily the best. It was actually a really incredible season of TV, but the show is weirdly kind of under the radar now. So it kind of like happened without a lot of people noticing. But it was one of the best scripted things I saw all of last year, really. And with the final season premiering in just a couple of weeks, if you're going to catch up, might as well catch up now. So I'll throw in my hat into the ring for that.
Okay. I'm also going to say that the double feature of SWAT and Basic is definitely worth a look.
Oh, we've talked about Basic on this show.
Yeah, we have. Love Basic. Anyway, coming to theaters, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. I saw the original Sin City my senior year of high school. And then immediately after that movie, I kissed my high school sweetheart for the first time, and we became boyfriend and girlfriend. Context, that was fucking 9 years ago. So yeah, I guess they decided that they were finally going to make that sequel that everyone was really hoping for back in 2005.
Oh man, I was one of those people waiting with bated breath for Sin City.
Yeah, I was, honestly. I don't know if you're being... I can never tell if you're being
sincere. No. You have to understand, like, the first Sin City came out when I was, like, 12.
Okay.
So, at the age of 12, I thought that was, like, the greatest film ever made.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was, like, the peak of human art.
It's like, oh, they did it. You're just like, it's done. They made it. And then
human art.
For the sake of clarification, I don't feel that way anymore. Let's just be clear.
No, I own this, and I haven't watched it. I'm sure I'd still like it, but I mean, 9 years is a long time to wait for a sequel to a movie that I don't remember being successful monetarily, even though it was fun as fuck.
I guess it was successful, but I'm just glad that they actually traveled back in time to use the same technology made, to use the technology used to make the first film. It looks like this movie is way out of time and kind of almost archaic.
Well, you know, he's all about the grindhouse aesthetic, you know, always made him look older. I don't know.
All about not working too hard, anyway.
He's got a lot of great people on it, too. I guess many people who were like, oh, yeah, I love that movie, I'll sign on.
I mean, hey, Ava Green, that's a good way to get me to watch just about anything.
Did you watch the new 300?
No, I haven't seen that yet, but it's on the queue.
I've heard that it's not terrible, and I still want to see it because I've heard that Ava Green alone in it makes it worth the cost of admission.
Yeah, same here, and yeah, maybe I'm just saving that. I'm like delayed gratification. Who knows?
Possible. Jeremy fucking Piven is in this movie, and Christopher Lloyd. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the cast list for Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. What else is coming out?
If I Stay.
If I Stay, which I believe I've seen a trailer for.
If you haven't watched that trailer, I really recommend blind watching it.
It was hilarious, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I remembered about it.
Also, Love is Strange by Ira Sachs.
Yeah, I really want to see that.
Also, weirdly enough, this is getting buried, is a movie called Are You Here?, which is the feature writing and directing debut of Matthew Weiner, the showrunner behind Mad Men.
Oh, really? Mm.
Oh,
it stars Owen Wilson, Zach Galifianakis, and Amy Poehler.
I guess it's not good.
It has a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, dear.
So
I know people who are. I know, it's like I keep saying, how bad can it really be? And a friend of mine who's seen it is just, he said, it is it's horrendous.
Well, the fucking poster is a nightmare. It's got... I'll explain it to you people. Ladies and gentlemen at home, this is Are You Here? All lowercase letters. Amy Poehler stands like a kind of matronly behind a shitty old looking couch on which Zach Galifianakis and Owen Wilson sit lackadaisically. A chicken sits next to the couch because it is in fact in the middle of a farm field. And it's like a bright blue sky with wispy clouds and like a beautiful little bucolic town in the background, and then right under all of this it says, from the creator of Mad Men. What? This doesn't even look real. This looks like one of those things where it's like that trailer recut for The Shining. I can't believe this is a thing. Anyway, yeah. The one I love, I've heard nothing but good things about.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's something else. Oh, When the Game Stands Tall, which is a sports thing.
Yeah, and I've seen commercials for it. Looks like some kind of Friday Night Lights knockoff.
People are going to love this. I will not probably be one of them, but whatever. It doesn't matter. So let's. I don't know. Is anyone going to watch Sin City? Now I'm kind of curious.
I'll see it at some point. I'm actually more curious about the teaser for The Hateful Eight, which is going in front of it.
Oh yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Has not started shooting yet, but they have a teaser.
How about this, guys? How about we go see Sin City: A Dame to Kill For, and the entirety of our review is just talking about The Hateful Eight teaser?
Sure. I mean, I could not. I didn't express much patience, and I kind of broke down and read the script. So,
oh, you bastard!
I could just kind of tell you everything.
Quentin Tarantino is literally going to kill you right now.
Yeah, he's going to sue me.
Although he rewrote the ending.
Danny, random question.
Yeah.
If I Stay trailer, better or worse than the Breathe In trailer?
Oh, I actually don't know. Wait, no, I've probably seen the Breathe In trailer. But
Guy Pearce.
It wasn't that memorable.
Okay. All right, so this one's better.
Okay. Breathe In looked pretty bad, though.
Okay. So we're going to really, 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 really fucking briefly talk about stuff that we've watched on our own. All those reallys were for the benefits of my esteemed co-hosts, who, God bless them, always have a lot to say about the films they watch. So, Jeremy Smith, why don't you tell us something that you watched this week that you think we should check out?
I revisited Lucas Mudison's Show Me Love.
Okay.
Oh.
Also known as Fucking Amal. but it is a it's a beautiful film. It's beautiful, like a coming of age love story about two girls. And it's one of those things. One of those films that just, as bad as things have been lately in the news and all that kind of thing or stuff, it's this is a film that will really kind of make you like believe humanity isn't down for the count just yet. So
worth saving.
Yeah, it's a lovely film. It's still my favorite Mudison film.
All right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
On my vacation, I watched Hal Hartley's Henry Fool.
Two good ones to start off here.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say, Hal Hartley is one of the few students from the film conservatory at my school who actually went on to have a really fruitful career. So I should probably have seen something of his earlier. This was my first Hartley film, I'm sorry to say. But with the third film in this trilogy, Ned Rifle, having had several scenes shot at my college while I was there, and featured in the trailer, too, I will add, I figured it was about time, right before it premieres. I don't really know how to compare this to anything, really, because it feels rather unique and really it's tone and Hartley's formalism, too, feels... It actually reminded me quite a bit of my school. It seems like the sensibilities that kind of power a lot of the artistic expressions there are evident in this film, which is really fascinating to see. Granted, that won't really apply to many people who listen to this, but that's there. I really liked it a lot. It was kind of one of those movies that feels like it's just one small story in this really large world of strange people and strange incidents. If you've seen it, you know, it's about like this. I won't get into it because we have to hurry up. But it's rather good. And right. I look forward to watching Faye Grimm, the follow-up soon. Yeah, Henry Fool's really, really strong.
All right. Danny King.
I also did a rewatch of Ripley's Game. And I remember I had seen this film several years ago because right after I saw In the Line of Fire, I went through a big Malkovich phase.
As all young men must.
Right, right. And this movie like wasn't great at that time for me because it's a very understated kind of performance. But there's one line in the movie that I remembered. I remembered actually rewinding when I watched the film because it's so funny. He's getting like a piano made or something, and he asks the guy how long it's going to take, and the guy says about 6 months, and without dropping a beat, Malkovich just responds, "You have 13 days," and it's like an instant response. And I remember actually like rewinding that 10 times, like 5 years ago or something. But this movie is fantastic. It held up really well. It's got an amazing Morricone score. The performance is very good, and it's got this really sensational kind of set piece on a train with a lot of messy knifings. And it has, I think it has the same weapon that was used in The Counselor.
The bolido.
I think.
Ooh.
Or something very similar to it. So yeah, check it out.
All right. So I'm going to talk about. So last week I said I went through a kick and I wanted to see some stuff that I had seen like in college, and that I downloaded on DC++ because it seemed like it was cool and unknown. One of those things was the film Equilibrium. By director writer Kurt Wimmer.
Oh God,
Wimmer. Starring, yeah.
Now there is another reason we were watching this. A friend of mine was saying that they were watching Legends, which is a new show I believe on TNT that stars Sean Bean, and I said, "Has Sean Bean died yet?" And so I was like, "Yeah, he's died in like everything he's been in," and this was the first thing I thought of. He dies like immediately after quoting a William Butler Yeats poem. And I love William Butler Yeats, so that's like three hardcore reasons to watch this movie. And I'm not going to say it holds up, obviously. I think I was really drunk most of college, I said last year. Last year, oh boy, I might be drunk now. I said last week that I was really drunk through most of college, and that when I watch stuff like this, I was usually sort of plastered. It is, however, not an unfun film. Christian Bale being all Christian Bale-like. Sean Bean, of course, is in it. That obviously gives a movie a half star right there. William Fichtner, another half star. Also, I don't know. There's something about the concept of, like, a form of ninjutsu that involves guns. And just, like, the last 15 minutes of this movie alone, I mean, I think it's better than the hallway shootout in The Matrix, honestly.
Wow.
It's bananas.
I agree with you.
All right, thank you.
I am a defender of this film on the level that it is actually, all silliness aside, a pretty terrific action film when it gets down to business.
All right, thank you very much. I'm glad. There's a goddamn gunfight where Christian Bale saves a puppy. I mean, it's great. So yeah, if you can take off your critic glasses and put on your fun shades. That analogy got really bad really quickly. You can have a lot of fun with Equilibrium. It's a good time. It's a good time. I recommend it. You can probably find it at Best Buy for $2. That's it. That's all for today. Join us next week when we'll be talking about something, maybe. I don't know. Maybe we'll take the week off. Follow us on Twitter to find out. Film Stage Show. Yeah, you can follow the rest of us on Twitter and online, too. So let's tell them where they can do it. Jeremy Smith.
Online, I write for Any Cool News. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Beaks. I also would recommend that you check out my new podcast, Fire Talk With Me, if you're a Twin Peaks fan.
Oh, you know I am. I want to watch the whole show again first. I saw you tweet that out. I was like, I gotta hold back.
but yeah, if you want to watch along, I don't know. I think we're having fun, so.
All right. Excellent. Nick Newman.
TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny King.
TheFilmStage.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and TheKingBulletin.com.
You can find me on my personal site, DearFilm.net, as well as TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, once again for joining us, and tune in maybe next week.